So what I'll be talking about is this subject of back reaction from spatial averaging in cosmology, which has picked up a lot of interest in the last couple of years. And I've been in this field also for the last couple of years. The reason it has picked up a lot of interest is because it's apparently a very simple idea, which may have had the potential to explain dark energy. And that got people very excited. It got me also very excited. In this talk, I'm going to try to convince you why this doesn't happen. So it's a negative result. It was kind of disappointing, but I will try and lay down as clearly as possible all the arguments that go into this this entire field, and yeah, I will show you what goes on. So since this is a broad audience, I've decided to keep things very general. I'll mainly be waving my hands around, but at crucial points, I'll go into details of some exact calculation that I've done, and please feel free to ask me any more details if you want. So these are the papers that I'll be talking about today. So when we look out into the universe with very good telescopes, we see lots of galaxies, and they're distributed in very interesting ways. One of the basic ideas that lies at the heart of the standard approach to cosmology is that on very large scales, the distribution of these galaxies appears to be almost approximately homogeneous. It doesn't matter where you look, the density of the galaxies appears to be almost the same everywhere. So if you're a cosmologist, you would try and quantify this by calculating two-point correlation functions and see how they behave at scale and so on. If you're a lay person, you can just squint your eyes at this picture and convince yourself that when you fuzz things out, the density remains the same everywhere. We also know that the cosmic microwave background radiation around us is highly isotropic. So apart from a relatively large dipole, which we believe is because of our local motion, the anisotropies in the CMBR are at the level of 10 parts per million or so. So this is what leads to what I would call the standard approach to cosmology, which is to assume that the universe is almost homogeneous and isotropic. Therefore, its metric must be of the Friedmann-Lemaitre-Robertson-Walker, the FLRW type, with small perturbations, which are inhomogeneous. You plug this metric into the Einstein equations and source the Einstein equations with the homogeneous and isotropic perfect fluid for the background homogeneous and isotropic cosmology. And this is what you get. These are the Friedmann equations. So I assume that you've come across these at some point of time or the other. Okay. But there is one issue, which is that we saw in that picture earlier, that homogeneity is not strictly valid on small scales. There is a lot of structure on small scale. And once you realize this fact, then you also start need to worry about two other issues. And these are the two other issues. I'll tell you why you need to start worrying about them. But the issues are firstly that GR is a nonlinear theory. So just to set some symbolic notation, if you write the metric as G, then the first partial derivatives of the metric are the Christoffel connections gamma. And the Einstein tensor constructed from this metric has this structure. Del gamma plus gamma squared. And these are the Einstein equations. P is the energy momentum tensor. So clearly this is a nonlinear theory. We know this, of course. The second point that you need to worry about is that you've said that, look, I looked at the galaxy's distribution in the universe, and on large scales it's homogeneous. What kind of metric would be sourced by a homogeneous and isotropic distribution? It has to be the FLRW metric. But in saying this, in making the statement, you have already assumed an implicit spatial averaging. You've brought in this notion in your mind of an averaging procedure without actually writing it down explicitly. So I'm going to try and tell you why this is something you need to think about. So this is not my idea. This idea goes back all the way to 1984. George Ellis was the first to point this out. And he said that if you apply Einstein's equations for an inhomogeneous universe and then say that what I'm actually interested in is not all the details of the inhomogeneities, but in large scale behavior. So I would want to apply the equations and take an average. Good. So this is what you would do on the right hand side. You apply the equations and then take some kind of average. I haven't told you what this average is. It would be a complicated thing. But just heuristically, if there was a way of averaging out tensors, etc., this is what you would want to do. What you actually do is to say that I have a geometry which, after I do the average, behaves like FLRW. And I will plug this into the Einstein tensor. So I will construct the Einstein tensor for this average geometry and equate it to the average energy momentum tensor. So what I actually do is construct this object, the Einstein tensor for the average metric, and equate it to this object. But there is a problem, because these two objects, because of nonlinearities, need not be the same. So it is possible that it is true that we are missing some terms here. It is possible that these terms could be significant, and we just don't know what they are. So you have to ask this question, what are these extra terms that you would get, and how big are they? Okay. So this is the main topic of my talk. I should also mention that the idea of how inhomogeneities affect cosmological behavior, cosmological expansion, has also been attacked from a different approach, which is to say that maybe the universe around us is not as homogeneous as we think it is, even on scales out to maybe several hundreds of megaparsecs. So this is what I call the special observer assumption. So what people typically do is to say, let us assume that we live in the center of a very large void and ask how light propagation would get affected. It would be different in general from FLRW light propagation, and people try and explain dark energy using this. So this is not my work, but I'm mentioning it here because there's an important difference between these two ways of doing things. So in this way of doing things, you're essentially building models. So you say that I'll build a model and I will go and compare it against data, and then your data can rule out your model. This approach, which I'm going to talk about, is an entirely theoretical approach. So it goes to the question of how you're defining your theory. So you're saying that I want FLRW as the basis of my theory, but then I have to be careful and do things correctly. So this is basically a calculation that needs to be done. So my argument in this talk is that although it is technically possible to have large effects coming from back reaction, in the real world, it is extremely unlikely that back reaction actually significantly influences the cosmological expansion. So for the rest of the talk, what you need to remember is that the back reaction term that I'm talking about has this broad structure. So remember that the Einstein tensor has this nonlinear structure, and we are looking at differences between either constructing the Einstein tensor for the average metric or averaging the inhomogeneous Einstein tensor. So the extra terms that you get will roughly be of this form. This is what we are after. And again, I have not yet told you what the averaging operation is. This is a nice thing, because most of the arguments in this talk are actually independent of what the specific details of the averaging are. So they're going to be rather heuristic arguments. But I will, of course, be using a specific averaging scheme to show you some exact calculations as well.
Do you mean the quantum averaging or spatial?
No, this is spatial averaging.
Just spatial. Yes.
There's no quantum physics here at all. It's completely classical. So here's what I'll do in the rest of the talk. I'll start with some calculations in linear theory, which is simple and well understood. And no one expects that averaging will give rise to large fluctuations in linear theory. And this is true. This doesn't happen. But it turns out that there are some important lessons that you can draw from linear theory which carry over to the nonlinear regime as well, which is the regime of interest, because one of the nice things about using back reaction as an answer to dark energy would be a completely natural solution for the coincidence problem. The proponents of back reaction would say something like this. So you have structures forming. Initially, the linear theory is a good approximation, and there's no back reaction. Then as structures start forming and things become nonlinear, back reaction becomes important. It starts giving rise to a dark energy-like term, and therefore you have a natural explanation for why dark energy starts becoming important when structures start forming. So it would be a very interesting answer to the coincidence problem, which is why you need to ask what happens in the nonlinear regime. So here I'll start with some dimensional arguments, and we'll see how far we can take the dimensional arguments. It turns out that they have their limitations, and you have to do calculations in exact solutions. So I will use one such exact solution, a spherical collapse model, using a completely relativistic spherical collapse model, and we'll see what happens. Okay. So let's start with early times, around the time of last scattering, let us say, when almost everyone would agree that linear perturbation theory in both the metric and the macro variables is a good approximation. So this is what I will use as my metric in the Newtonian gauge. Right. So now remember that the correction term that we are after have this structure. It's average of gamma squared minus gamma average squared. So what is going to happen is that gamma has derivatives of the metric in it. So you will expect derivatives of scale factor and phi. But the scale factor is homogeneous. And it's going to be a constant with respect to the averaging. So it will completely drop out. So you will only have derivatives of phi coming in. And let's, for fun, assume that at late times you'll have a matter-dominated universe where phi is not evolving too much. So time derivatives of phi are probably not that important. So what you'll have is spatial derivatives of phi. So you expect that the correction terms will have this form. So 1 over a squared, because this grad is with respect to co-moving coordinates. Otherwise, it's supposed to have this form. Now just use your, so we'll do a little cheating. We'll say, let us suppose that we know what our background cosmology is doing, and just estimate what the back reaction would be. So you plug in your transfer function and your initial power spectrum, etc. Take a scale invariant form and so on. This is the normalization of the initial power spectrum. This is the scale of matter radiation equality, etc. Plug in the number, then you get something like 10 to the minus 4. So you see that in the linear regime, the back reaction is extremely small. Good. So you at least expect that at early times the back reaction is small. Of course, like I said, we cheated here. We assumed that we know the evolution of A in calculating what the back reaction was. Actually, what we need to do is to solve this loop. So you have a background cosmology. It tells you how perturbations are evolving. The perturbations go and determine what the back reaction is. And the back reaction sits in the equation which determines the background. So a priori, you have no way of breaking this loop, because where do you start? But the calculation in the previous slide at least indicates that maybe it's a good idea to do things iteratively. So let's do the first iteration, the zeroth iteration calculation, assuming there's no back reaction, like we did in the previous slide. Then once you have this function as a function of time, you can go back and put it into your equations and get a first guess for what the new scale factor should be. And hopefully, if you do this a few times, you should converge and you'll know what the actual scale factor is. And of course, if you don't converge, then that's an interesting thing as well, because then it means that you've actually missed something which you need to take into account. Okay, so here are the results from some exact calculations. So I have used the Zaleratnikov averaging framework. Now, unfortunately, for lack of time, I will have absolutely no time to go into any details here. I will just say that Zaleratnikov's averaging framework allows you to, so what it does is to introduce some new structures which define a weighting scheme. So, and this, using this weighting scheme, you can take an arbitrary tensor and define an average tensor. So it essentially tells you how to, given a tensor at a point, how to define tensors at other points so that you can perform an integral and get out an object which you can legitimately call an average tensor. The reason I'm using this scheme as opposed to some other schemes which involve simply averaging out scalar equations and so on is because what I bought ultimately is an equation for this A of tau which includes the back reaction. So I need one scale factor which I'm determining using my back reaction, whatever, using my corrected equations. The other schemes in the literature, for those in the know, Bucherd scheme, for example, doesn't allow you to do this, because if you try to do perturbation theory in Bucherd's approach, you would end up with two scale factors. One would be this, and the other would be Bucherd's scale factor. But anyway, that's technical detail. So in this scheme, what happens is that the correction terms take the form of these four functions, P1, S1, P2, S2. I'll show you what these functions are. Apart from the standard, from the other thing. So here I'm in the model that I calculated things in, I'm only assuming radiation and matter, no cosmological constant, of course, because that's what we want to test, that these things can be bad. So what? So the results are here. These functions in k-space look like this. So they're k-space integrals. So this p sub phi I is the initial power spectrum of metric fluctuations. This capital phi is basically the transfer function. It's defined here. So the Fourier transform of the metric fluctuations is defined as the initial bit times the transfer function. And the transfer function appears here. The prime is a derivative with respect to conformal time. So you have three functions, P1, P1 plus P2, and S2, which depend on time derivatives. And you have one function which doesn't depend on time derivatives. It has some spatial derivatives. There are some things that you need to note about these things, about these functions. So let's see. So it turns out, it's obvious for S2, and it's actually also true for this one and this one, that the functions which have time derivatives involved actually are divergent if you assume completely scale invariant power spectrum all the way out to infinite radians. So this is a problem. And this is actually not surprising. So you expect this divergence to be here because of what, because of the assumptions that you made. So you've already started by assuming that I can do a spatial averaging and from this inhomogeneous metric recover FRW. If you have perturbations out to arbitrarily large wavelengths, then no matter what finite scale of spatial averaging you choose, you will never be able to recover FRW. So clearly, you, by making the assumption that averaging gives rise to FRW, you also have to simultaneously make the assumption that there must be a cutoff scale beyond which there are no fluctuations. So for my calculations, I have assumed that there is a sharp cutoff. So yes.
Can I just ask you, Hussein, that last comment you made about having to have FRW as a limit, do you mean exact FRW or approximate FRW as a limit? You probably mean exact, don't you?
Yes. For my calculations, I'm using exact FRW as a limit. Yes. Okay. So these things are formally divergent, but the way I deal with things is to just put in a cutoff on small scales. There must be a better way of doing things. There must be a better way of handling super horizon fluctuations. I haven't found it yet. But yeah, I'm willing to discuss this later.
Put a cutoff at small k.
Small k, yeah, sorry, large scales. Okay, so for my two component model with radiation and matter, this is what the fluctuations, this is what the back reaction functions look like. So I normalize them with the time dependent Hubble parameter. So I'll just point out one feature of this plot. Look at the solid line, which is S1, which contains only spatial derivatives. So at late times, as expected, so from our order of magnitude calculations, this is the dominant contributor. The time derivatives are not important. And so this is a log-log plot. And actually, if you look carefully, this is actually linear. So this function is linearly increasing with scale factor. Which means, because h squared in the Macker-dominated regime goes as 1 over 8 cubed, the fact that this object is going linearly with a means that S1 is growing as 1 over a squared, which is exactly what we had in our order of magnitude approximation. And if you simply extrapolate this out to today, just for fun, you'll find that you get a number like 10 to the minus 4. So what you see is that our order of magnitude approximation is actually working very, very well at late times.
How sensitive is it to your choice of cutoff?
So this function is not at all sensitive because it is convergent. It has no depend. There is a k squared sitting in front of the integral, so it converges very nicely. These two functions are logarithmically sensitive. This one is quadratically sensitive, the S2. So in fact, so it's this guy. This worries me actually because, and it should worry you because I've not shown you any of the details that go into this calculation. right. So the question is, okay, so I should say this. Zavadzinov's averaging scheme does not give you a unique framework for averaging. So I told you that it prescribes a weighting scheme using which you can define averages of tensors. Turns out that this weighting scheme is not unique. You still have to make certain choices. I have made the best possible choices that I can by requiring things like perturbation theory should remain stable and so on and so forth. It may be that there is a cleverer choice that I could make which would get rid of this quadratic divergence. I strongly think that this is not the case because I did spend some time, this worried me quite a bit. So I spent some time trying to figure out other choices and trying to motivate them, etc. But I think you will, if you make another choice, maybe S2 will be well behaved, but you know, the divergence will be shifted to some of these other functions.
So I mean, there is, this is the issue that I mean, I think the first time Colvin re-observed for our top that the Darley's divergence is in the infrared.
Mm.
And of course, I think the way to address them is the way you address all divergences in quantum field theory, that if you express observables in terms of observables, then things should be decoupled from these divergences. At least in normalizable theories, that's the case. And I believe that, I think that is for the divergence that they had. So we showed that if you express things in terms of cosmological parameters, this is just a normalization of the curvature. So if of course these are the bare parts. So this is basically these are the bare corrections to the bare theory.
Mm-hmm.
But then if question is can you reformulate them as a normalization of your cosmological parameters like curvature and other things. And that's where if you question is in that sense would it be independent of the cutoff or not? So then the bare corrections might be infinite. But the normalized corrections might be fine. So that's a possibility. I'm not sure about this, but
this is IR. This is IR.
But it's the same game.
Not really.
Well, I mean, for example, there is QED has an IR divergence, but if you look at physical observables, that's not present in terms of number of photons. And I think
yeah, but it's not a normalization. So
well,
it's divergent numbers of photons, for example.
That's right. Really,
you have to just very carefully define what you're measuring. I mean, there's a sort of question maybe I could just ask at this point.
Sure.
Why are you averaging at 4?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why wouldn't one just say I try to make the best possible fit to our observed universe, which consists of some fluctuations and some smooth
So the idea that I have is that your background has to be special in some way. Why choose
just
a particular
best fit? Best fit.
No, but the fact that you have chosen a homogeneous and isotropic background, this statement has to, you have to attach some specialness to it in some sense. So you have to say that there is some invariance maybe attached to it. So in this context, I would say that the reason FRW is special is because when I average FRW, I get back FRW. So.
Well, it's clearly special because it's homogeneous. It's just
yes, exactly. And
it's the best fitting homogeneous universe.
Yes, and the I'm just restating that homogeneity in terms of an average. So I'm saying that when I average FRW, I get back FRW, so it's special. Now, if I don't have FRW, how do I know what the FRW is, the underlying FRW is? I do an averaging and I kill all the fluctuations.
Well, if I have a curve like this, I'm saying what's the best fit straight line? But,
yeah,
and I find the best fit straight line. So. Is it any different? I don't need to average anything.
Well, what exactly are you using to fit the curve? What is your input?
That it's a straight line?
No, but what is the theory? Are you assuming?
Oh, assume there is a theory which has certain power spectrum fluctuation.
Yeah.
So I just find that given that theory, what's the best fitting method?
But isn't the idea of this that the actual background theory could actually have correction terms as well?
I'm not really sure what they would be.
I think shouldn't one always reconstruct a metric starting from the whatever is like a real physical observable, like a matter. So in this, for example, if it was earlier stages, I could see that I use the constant 5 surfaces and then rebuild my cosmology based on that. In this case, it's harder because you have the nonlinear structure of matter, but maybe I could start with some radiation background and then build my metric on the top of that, define my word lines based on that, and then go back.
I haven't thought about that yet. No, I'd have to spend some time thinking about this.
Because I agree, it's a very confusing concept. Just you average something and you come over the expansion, but in the end, you're not sure whether it really corresponds to any observable or not. Is it?
So here, all I'm saying is that you have what you would usually do is to say I have an FRW metric with a scale factor, and I will model the behavior of the scale factor based on various other things that I know. For example, I know that pressureless dark matter should behave in certain ways and radiation should behave in certain ways, and then I have a scale factor as a function of time. I'm putting in the added input that the fact that you're writing down a single scale factor in a metric is special. And it is special because when you average this object out, it recovers itself. And when you build this into the theory, you end up with these correction terms, which you also have to take into account. So I don't know whether that answer is any.
Let's talk about it.
Okay. All right, so let's move on from here. So I'd like to point out certain things that you can already learn from the linear theory calculation. So the first thing is what I call the dynamical suppression of back reaction. In other words, you get out what you put in. So remember, we had this loop in which the background determines the perturbations, which determine the back reaction, which determine the background. Suppose you want a large back reaction, what would you need? You would need a non-standard growth of fluctuations. Where would this growth come from? It can only come if your scale factor is evolving in a very non-standard way. But that, in the absence of anything else, can only happen if the back reaction is large to begin with. So the only way to get a large back reaction is if you put in a large back reaction. And we argued earlier that the back reaction at early time should be small. So you expect that the back reaction tends to keep itself small. And this is true provided perturbation theory holds. If perturbation theory does not hold, if something else comes in and breaks perturbation theory, maybe nonlinear effects, I don't know. So if something like that happens, then all bets are off. But if perturbation theory is breaking down, then I think back reaction is the least of your problem because you have to deal with many other things. So as long as perturbation theory in the metric is valid, I would say that back reaction will tend to remain small, even in the nonlinear regime. So
is this true even in non-standard theory? It's like something like GME where you have some change in behavior.
As far as I know, this is a completely open question. So I have only looked at GR. Most other people also only look at GR.
I mean, the argument that you're giving sounds completely general. You're just saying perturbation theory, but if you have some scale in the middle.
Yeah. So the thing is, you have to ask how the back reaction is behaving. So here in our calculation, we see that the back reaction behaves like a curvature, so like the first iteration. And a curvature can't lead to a non-standard growth. So if you have another theory in which your first iteration itself is giving you some non-standard growth, then maybe things could be different. But I haven't really looked at any other theory apart from GR. Okay, the second thing that one can notice is if you plot the integrands of the various back reaction functions, you will see that non-linear scales are actually contributing very little. So this is a linear theory calculation, but let's just extrapolate things to where they become mildly non-linear. So what I've plotted here is a part of the integrand that goes into S1, which is the dominant contribution, at different times. So the solid line is the latest time, and this wiggly line is the earliest time. And on the right-hand side, I've plotted the dimensionless density contrast as a function of scale, also for the same times. So you see that the density contrast, so let's look at the latest time here, the solid line. So at this end, it's going up to more than 0.1, about 0.2 or so. And it's becoming mildly nonlinear now. But its contribution in the integrand is very small. So most of the contribution is coming from these scales, and the nonlinear contribution is here. Now, of course, when you do a proper nonlinear calculation, you will boost up the power on small scales. But so people study this, they calculate nonlinear power spectra and so on. The effect there is, so you change the transfer function by maybe two or three orders of magnitude at certain scales. Suppose you do that, suppose you make a very drastic change and even shift this function which is bending down and crank it up and make it flat. So suppose that function went like this. You can go back to your integral and check that this particular combination is appearing in the integral against a logarithmic measure. And this is a log-log plot. So even if you pull this all the way out here, flat, the effect over here will be addressed a factor of a few. So drastic changes in the power spectrum because of nonlinear effects are also not expected to significantly modify the back reaction magnitude. Okay. So with that, let's move to the nonlinear regime, which is far more complicated because you can't really do too many analytical things. You have to go to simulations or very complicated equations. So let's try and start with dimensional arguments. So suppose that perturbation theory in the metric is valid, which is what most people do. We want to test this assumption, whether things are going wrong somewhere. So if it is valid on small scales, then the relevant equation is the cosmological version of the Poisson equation, right? So it's del squared phi is 4 pi g delta, where this delta is the density contrast defined like this. And as before, the back reaction, because you have perturbation theory in the metric, it would behave like this. So suppose you have an overdense or underdense region of physical size capital R. Then on dimensional grounds, you can treat this combination as 1 over R. And just plug things in and see what you get. And your background density will behave like h squared. So you have phi going as hr the whole square times delta. This is actually a textbook calculation. You'll find it in Hegel somewhere. So now let's start putting in some numbers. Suppose you take a void, okay, a sub-Hubble void, which is very deep. So its density contrast is close to minus 1. Plug things into the back reaction, and you'll find that the back reaction is like this. In general, there will be a delta squared multiplying this thing. So I've set delta to 1 so it doesn't appear. Otherwise, it's like this. And because I'm in the sub-Hubble limit, hr the whole squared is much less than 1. So I have a small back reaction. Clearly, this shows that if you have really, really large voids, gigaparsec size voids like the ones that Paul et al. Have been using in their recent work, then this argument breaks down. So yeah, so this argument does not work when you have extremely large and extremely underdense voids. For overdensities, you need to be a little more careful because if you look at this, there's a delta hanging around here, and delta is going to grow very large. So you have to be slightly more careful. So let's see what to do. So in a typical spherical collapse situation, you have a parameterized version of the evolution. The radius of a shell goes as 1 minus cos u, and time goes as u minus sin u. So it's a parameterized thing. As u goes to 2 pi, you're reaching a singularity. So you plug things into the density. Density goes like this. This density contrast behaves like that. Go through the calculation, and you get something for phi. You get something for c. Both of these things have a 1 minus cos u dependence in the denominator. So apparently, if you take things out to very late times, u goes to 2 pi, you will have c growing out to h squared or even larger, and also phi growing to order 1 or even larger. So apparently, there's a breakdown in perturbation theory. So the question is this actually happening in the real world, or is it just an artifact of the model? So it could just be that your model is being pushed into a regime that you shouldn't be pushing. Good. So my claim is the following, that perturbation theory in the metric does not in fact break down at late times. And the reason for this is that observed peculiar velocities of galaxies remain small. We know that we see small peculiar velocities, and I will explain this statement. What is happening is that the spherical collapse model does not remain to be a good approximation at late times. So what happens in the spherical collapse model is that you have a region of space, a space which is expanding like that, and so there's this matter, and then it starts falling in, and it just keeps falling in, and it goes into a singularity. In the real world, this is not going to happen because there will be clumps of matter which have random motions, and there will be this. So there is this concept of virialization. So basically, you have things going around each other, and this random velocities will generate a pressure support and create stable objects. And this is what you see in clusters of galaxies. So this simple model of spherical collapse does not capture this physics. So if you want to describe this physics, you have to do much more. So if you simply take the spherical collapse model all the way out to the singularity, that is not a good approximation. And if you work out the time scales involved, it turns out that the time at which you should stop trusting the spherical collapse model happens before peculiar velocities start becoming large. So things seem to be working fine. So to make this more explicit, we did an exact calculation in what is known as the LTV solution, the Lemaitre-Tolman boundary solution. So this is the metric for the solution. It has dust as its source, pressureless dust, and it's spherically symmetric. And T is the proper time of dust shells, which are labeled by this coordinate little r, so it's a four-moving coordinate. Capital R is the physical radius of each dust shell. This K of R is an integration constant that appears very much like the curvature parameter appears in the FRW spacetime. So in fact, FRW is a special case of this metric. So instead of going into the gory details of what exactly this R is and so on, I thought I'll explain things in pictures. But I should tell you that capital R, so once you specify the initial conditions for this model, capital R as a function of P and little r is a known, is analytically known. It can be written down in parametric form. Okay. So the model that we chose had initial conditions which were a perturbation around Einstein de Sitter, which is omega n equals 1. And there were two important radii in our model, what we call r star and rp. So basically what you have is an overdensity out to radius r star, then an underdensity out to radius rv. So this inner radius is, this inner dotted line is r star, outer solid line is rv. And at initial time, which where we had a scale factor value of 10 to the minus 3, this outer radius was around 23.5 kilopascals. Now you run through the evolution and see what happens at present epoch in this model. So at present epoch, the relative sizes of the these two radii turn out to be this. So this is clearly a non-perturbative effect. Okay, so the relative sizes of these models have visually changed. So clearly it can't be a perturbative effect. The other thing is that look at the outer radius. So it's 23.5 kiloparsecs at a scale factor value of 10 to the minus 3. So if you had a perturbative effect, then at scale factor value 1, which is present, you would expect 23.5 megaparsecs. But actually what you get is something like 33 megaparsecs. So even this is a non-perturbative effect. So your model is a non-perturbative model for structure formation, because what is happening here is that this outer radius, which is in an underdense region, is expanding very fast. This inner radius has expanded out and is now collapsing, and it has come down to around 7 megaparsec or so. And your metric captures this entire behavior in a completely non-perturbative way. The question we want to ask, okay, so in more conventional terms, before I go on, this is what the density contrast does in the overdense region. So it's become very large. And in the underdense region, it has become very underdense. So the question we want to ask is, can we go from this non-perturbative metric to a metric which is a perturbation around the original Einstein de Sitter model through a coordinate transformation? So you would usually, in standard cosmological perturbation theory, you would have this notion of gauge transformation. You make small coordinate transformations to go from one form of the metric to the other. Now you're in a non-perturbative situation, so you can't use small gauge transformation, but maybe a large coordinate transformation might do. So it turns out that you can actually do this. You can define new coordinates in this way and go through the calculation, and you can actually recover explicit expressions for phi and psi. These expressions have to be numerical because the model is complicated and so on, but I'll show you results for what phi is. Phi and psi turn out to be equal, although it comes out in a very complicated way. Right, so the point is that you can do this provided a particular condition is satisfied, and there is only one condition that needs to be satisfied, and it's that this object should remain much less than 1, where this V is defined in this way. It's the derivative of R tilde. And you can recognize this to be the co-moving peculiar velocity. So as long as the peculiar velocity in the model is small, you can actually do a coordinate transformation to go from this non-perturbative metric to a perturbation around FRW. And this is what your potential and the velocity looks like for our particular choices of initial conditions, etc. So it remains very small. This is like 10 to the minus 5. Yeah, 2 into 10 to the minus 5. The velocity also remains small at the 10 to the minus 3 level. And for completeness, what we did was to ask, so now you've recovered perturbed FRW in this model. You already have a formalism in which you can calculate the back reaction whenever you have a perturbed FRW metric. So we did this. And the dominant contribution looks like this. So this is S1 again. It doesn't behave like a curvature-like term, which would be this. It has some very non-trivial evolution, which is happening because your model is non-linear. So you have this. So you're not solving the linear perturbation theory equations, even though your metric is being treated as a linear perturbation around FRW. The matter perturbations are very large, and they give rise to very complicated behavior. But anyway, the point is that the effect is still small. And in fact, it is much smaller than what you would expect from linear perturbation theory. So you're getting only something like 10 to the minus 5 or so less than that. And this is again in line with what I was saying earlier, that nonlinear effects are not expected to contribute too much. In this model, all we have are small-scale inhomogeneities. We have no large-scale inhomogeneities, so you don't get that 10 to the minus 4 that you were getting earlier. So I'll summarize. I've tried to show that corrections to the cosmological equations because of averaging are real and non-trivial, but they appear to be negligible if you're given realistic initial conditions and evolution models. And the way I argued the thing was as follows. We argued that the corrections are small at early times. They remain dynamically suppressed at late times, provided perturbation theory in the metric is valid. Perturbation theory in the metric remains valid, provided peculiar velocities remain small. And we see that peculiar velocities are small. So it closes the argument, and you have a small effect. There are some loopholes. You could say that these conclusions are based on linear theory calculations and toy models. Maybe when you do a full-fledged simulation, things would be different. I don't expect things to be different because I think the arguments are sound, but you could, in principle, do more accurate calculations in n-body simulations. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Any question?
Yeah, I guess about your last point, I should have asked at the beginning, but how is what you're doing different from what people already do in n-body simulations where you do recalculating at each? I mean, when people do simulations of string information, they do recalculate perturbation from the step by step. So
they calculate the perturbation step by step, but the background is fixed. You choose one background, and then you don't change it. What I'm saying is that you need to change the background at every stage.
But since they're doing, I agree they fix the background, but since you then do a local calculation on top of that, wouldn't they see an inconsistency, or wouldn't you? The original question, how do you, is it valid to choose some initial background, and then as long as you have your background?
Yeah, well, if you go by this argument, it is valid.
Yeah, exactly.
It is, yes. So I'm saying this is like a, it's not something, I don't expect this to break down in n-body simulations. It's just that if, you know, there are people, okay, you're clearly convinced that it's not going to work. There are people who are not convinced, in fact, they're convinced the other way, that n-body simulations are not capturing these effects correctly. I think they're wrong. And if you do a calculation in n-body simulation, you won't get anything different from this.
Yeah, so there is this, let's add this.
Okay.